Hello, Vashon and Maury Islands. This is History Worth Hearing, a presentation of the Vashon Heritage Museum, and I am your host, Chris Austin. We have an interesting show for you this month. We'll talk with Marla Smith, one of the panelists for the April Museum Talk, Potters on Vashon in the 1970s and 80s. And we have an interview with Josie Islin. She will discuss her work with the Natural Wonder exhibit at the museum. But unfortunately, I have to begin with some troubling news that you may have already read in the Beachcomber. Last month, the Washington State Department of Antiquities, that's the organization that accredits museums, conducted a standard inspection of the Vashon Heritage Museum, and they came to a startling conclusion. The department states that many of the artifacts on display in the museum are actually fakes. They are working on the theory that someone with access to the museum has been stealing items and replacing them with copies while selling the real ones on eBay or, more likely, the dark web. For instance, the large tree section with rings that can be traced back to the 1620s, that's actually a piece of plywood with a very convincing paint scheme. The stone tools that are on display, if you look closely, they're actually Lego. Yeah. And the portraits of early settlers on the island, we found out those are actually the photos that came with the picture frame. We don't even know who those people are. This is very disturbing, and I'm sure you will hear more about this as events unfold. But remember, you heard it here first on Friday, April 1st. April Fools! Did I get you? I'm sorry, I just couldn't resist. There is no Washington Department of Antiquities, and everything in the museum is real. Okay, Vashon, as promised, I have a guest for you. It is Marla Smith, the potter. Not the photographer, the same name. And she is a panelist on this month's museum talk, Vashon Potters of the 1970s and 1980s. And Marla, if you could just give us a little background about yourself, how you're involved with pottery.
Sure. I came here in 1973 at the tender age of 21, where I thought I was a complete grown-up. And I was working in Seattle at the Factory of Visual Arts. And I had dropped out from college and was absolutely obsessed with clay. And I met a woman there named Lila Miller. We didn't meet in person, but she saw my pot. We were like trains passing in the night. We were never in the studio at the same time. And she saw my pots and she wanted to know who I was. And we met and became friends, and really became colleagues. We appreciated each other's work tremendously. And she knew of a potter friend of hers from Pottery Northwest. At that time was a very big deal in the city. It still is a big deal, but at that point, studio time could be rented there. So a potter could go there and work, have a wheel, have incredible firing there. And so there were a lot of different potters there at the time. And one of her friends had gone to Vashon, 4 years previously, and had started a pottery out there. He needed to go back to New York to help his father with his business. And Lila wanted to know if I wanted to go out there and take over this pottery. So I said, yes, that sounded good. And I went out and she said, oh, you don't, I had a funny little car, really, really old Datsun at the time. But she said, oh, you don't need to drive. You'll be able to get a ride from the ferry, no problem. So I did a lot of what she said, which sometimes was a mistake. But at that point, she said, yeah, you can just hitch from the ferry. So I hitched from the ferry and it took a really long time to get a ride. I still remember the person who gave me this ride. I kind of watched him with IA. And I got out to this pottery and saw what it was. And it was an old, old house with many, many, many dead cars in the front yard and an incredible orchard. And behind it was this pottery that was an old shed that with several wheels in it, and a greenhouse that was made out of visqueen and chicken wire, and a kiln with everything sooty around it. And I was completely entranced. And so she subsequently went away and so left me on my own to kind of hold our place, because here was this 5 acres and a house for dirt cheap. And so I was there as the placeholder until she came back from Mexico, so nobody would get it while she was gone. And so I did that, and she came back, and we continued on in the tradition. And this man's name was Monty Levine, who started it. And I'm pretty sure, in thinking about all of this and doing some research, that that was the first co-op pottery on Vashon. And he came in 1969 or 1968.
Well, you know, when I first heard about the talk, the title was curious to me. Why is the era of the 1970s and 80s so important in pottery on the island?
Well, previous to that, I know that there were potters here, and VAA was happening here. I don't know how many people were involved at that time. I think it was pretty. You know, as part of the whole Allied Arts organization. And so they wanted to have pottery, and there was an old log cabin where the Over Park playground is right now. I vaguely remember this old building. But previous to that, I'm sure there were potters and people working with clay in their homes, but there was no organized movement. Then all of a sudden, there were 16 people here within a matter of a few years. And so that's why, well, for one thing, pottery was taking off in Seattle. There had always been potters here, but, you know, the Summer of Love was, what, 1968? So that was really a time that a lot of people dropped out, and either from their jobs or college or whatever, and looked, you know, to become a part of the counterculture movement. So when people talk about why Akio Takamori came, it was also kind of a fluke in doing some research. A lot of people came here not knowing exactly what was here. But in the 70s, there was half of the population that there is now. And there were places to live. And where we rented a house for $75 a month, a sweet old broken down house, and 5 acres. So those places were available, and potters need space, and potters need outbuildings, and this was what it was.
You know, we used to have 25 brick factories on the island back in the day. You know, this is after Seattle and Tacoma, they had the big fires, and they wanted to build back with brick. And I'm wondering, is the quality of the clay on the island a draw for potters, like it was the brick guys?
No. You're right, and actually Bruce has a wonderful map that he got from a friend of his, I forget his name at this moment, of all of the brickyards on the island. And when I lived in Seattle on Capitol Hill, I was told that the especially the bricks, I lived down at the bottom of the hill, but Aloha is a street that comes up and over east west, and for parts of it, it was still bricks when I lived there. And I don't know how I was talking to somebody, and supposedly the bricks from the Seattle streets and down in Pioneer Square came from the Vashon brickyard. And they are these big oversized red bricks, and they're very, very dense. But the clay on Vashon fires at a very, very low temperature. It's really, you have to do a lot of work to make it, to break it down into particle sizes small enough that you could actually use it to build with. And so that obviously the brick yards had big crashing, thrashing, pounding machines. And then it was fired at a fairly low temperature, even though the bricks are very dense. So we use people of the earth, which is what we thought we were. We went out and mined clay and brought it back and tried to flake it down and ended up having to screen everything. And we use it for a glaze, or as part of a glaze. We made the classic hippie glaze of fireplace ashes from an airtight stove. Remember those little airtight stoves, those sheet metal stoves? that were everything. We all had them. And so we would use that, and it has flux in it. And then we would use the clay that we had beat down into a pulp. And then we could use that. We experimented with that and used it for glaze.
Interesting. Wow. I had no idea that was involved process.
Oh, yeah. Clay, as I have told people when, you know, over the years when I've told them that I work with clay, you know, the classic response is, oh, I would love to do that. It looks like so much fun. So much fun. But the majority, the majority of it is carrying weight. You know, you carry the clay in, or in our case, we made our clay from dry ingredients. So we unloaded 100-pound bags of kaolin and all this other stuff, threw it into a big sausage mixer, and ground it all up, took these big clumps, threw it into garbage cans, let it age, pulled these big, it's nothing but, it's work. Really, really hard on your lower back, really hard on your shoulders, really hard on your hands. So potters who have been potters for decades are not potters. Or they have changed radically the way they work. And the way that it has been done in, probably in Europe as well, I'm sure in Europe as well, but especially I know much more about the Japanese way of doing it, where pottery is, you know, it's a national, potters are national treasures. And there's this, you know, thousands of years old tradition. And the potters who are older and are masters, they don't do all that hard work. They have apprentices who are eager to be in their presence and to do all that work. But so much of clay is hard work. Even the pots are heavy. We sold at the Pike Place Market, and we'd park our funky trucks and down on Elliott, and then we would have all those stairs to carry the boxes of pots up to the top, right? So the majority of clay work is, it is really lifting weight, but when you're an addict, you're really an addict.
Well, I think a lot of people, they think of pottery, they go to the classic goat scene from Ghost with Patrick Swayze, and how idealized it is and romantic, and they don't see the hard work. They don't see the how the sausage is made.
That's exactly it. Also, you know, if they see something, what I'm doing right now is that I'm hand building with porcelain, and porcelain is very, very rarefied. There is no sand, there is no grog in it, there's no tooth to it. It's like working with cream cheese in a sense, and it can be very, very unforgiving. Chris Beck is another person who works in porcelain, and she throws it and does some hand building. It's very fine, but it's very, very tricky. So what I'm asking it to do now, it's something that it doesn't want. It cooperates because it's a really good recipe. But so people will see it like a pot, a big bowl that I made, and the foot has cracked. So it's gone through the whole firing process. There's two firings. And they'll say, oh, look, oh, that's too bad. You know, it's like before I've taken the silver hammer to it. And I'll say, that's not, you know, there are so many ways for pots to go wrong. And I'm sure there are too with every medium, you know. And I know that, you know, painters can paint over some things. Glass artists, I'm sure they have a lot of different, I know they have a lot of different. But for clay, that it really is, half art and half craftsmanship, or half industrial craftsmanship.
Sounds like alchemy in some ways. Like,
you know what? You know, I mean, yeah, to be poetic, it is.
Well, I used to be a dentist, and I made porcelain crowns. I'm sorry, I spoke over you.
Oh, you did? You made porcelain crowns?
I made porcelain crowns, and it was unforgiving, but I cemented them in anyway.
So see, right there, that shows you what porcelain is, right? How incredibly strong it is. And isn't there something too, I mean, to get off pots, but isn't it true that, you know, if you're in a mouth, I actually work for a dentist for a little bit supporting my craft. I worked doing a lot of things supporting my craft, is that it has to expand as a human tooth and then contract as a human tooth, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, that's why 18 karat gold is like the best material, because it's got the hardness of a tooth. It's got the coefficient of expansion and contraction. That's the best. But in a practical sense, you've got this kind of nickel beryllium core that you build the porcelain on. And it's you know, you've got glue under there that kind of helps seal it up as well. So it's kind of a different. And porcelain is also harder than a natural tooth, and it will wear your teeth down if it's not done correctly.
Right.
Yeah.
Because it's fired to 2,400 degrees.
Oh, yeah. I've forgotten what that, you know, I only did them in school. When I got out in practice, yeah. I'm like, I'm not doing that anymore. I'm leaving that to the experts.
Right. Yeah. It's fired really high. And back in the 70s, that's what we used to fire to. You know, we were, you know, that was the thing. Stoneware was the thing. And we fired really high. We burned all sorts of fuel. And now things are changing so that we fire up to what's called high fire, what's called medium fire, and we're using much more electric. And this pottery where I was so fortunate to be at, it was caveman pottery. Cavewoman pottery. We made our own clay, which was not that common for a pottery to do. We made our own glazes, which was very common. Part of the whole stoneware culture was to make your own glazes. And there were coveted recipes that went down, you know, from the big potters of the time down. And then this particular kiln that I'll talk about during the panel was a kiln I've never known of any other one but this kiln. And I talked to the man, Monty, who made it, but it was fired with diesel.
Oh, really?
From Williams Heating.
Is that right?
It was fired with diesel. So it went from a puddle of diesel with a match lighting this puddle of diesel to 2350 degrees, you know, on diesel coming from a 50-gallon drum.
How did they manage the soot?
It was very sooty.
Wow.
It was very, very sooty. And there was a piece of angle iron right at forehead height when loading the kiln. And so everything had to go underneath that. And the shelves were silicon carbide. They weighed 20 pounds a piece. So you had to lift those shelves up underneath the angle iron and on top of pots that are already in there. So you don't want to get any.
Oh my gosh.
So it's a good thing we were really young, because that's how we did it. And then it was a lot of hard brick. And then we bricked up, there was no door, we just bricked up the front, which is very common for kilns like that. Well, there's all sorts of different ways to fire. And of course, you know, pots have been made forever. So there is a kiln on the island that is a wood fire kiln, 8 to 10 cords of wood to fire this kiln, and it can take 48 hours. So it's, in a sense, you know, heat goes up. So it's built like a climbing, it's a long, giant thing. There's all sorts of different ways of doing it. So the fire, you know, you start at the bottom and it goes, you know, you're throwing wood, tiny pieces that you have split in the burner ports on the side, and slowly, this everything in there, all the pots in there, all the kiln furniture, all the bricks, everything gets to this amazing temperature. But because of its wood is the fuel, there is wood ash everywhere in there. And so the ash, once again, like the hippie glaze made from ash and clay, Vachon clay, so the ash forms down and makes a glaze with the clay.
Oh, really?
Are these beautiful? I mean, it's like, if you can pull it off, it's like the the pièce de résistance, wood-fired pots. There's all sorts of beautiful, beautiful oranges and browns, and you can put slips underneath or oxides underneath. But it's a community effort.
Oh my gosh, I really think so. Well, can you tell us who else is on this panel with you?
On the panel is Irene Otis, who was here, I think, before 1970, and has been working all the way through. And Greg McElroy, who was here in the very early 70s. I'm not sure when he came, but right about my time. And he built himself a great, very together pottery, and was a potter for years and years and years. And also Chris Beck, who came with her husband, Joe Wheeler, and they also built a really together pottery and made pots together.
Well, can you tell us, how has the pottery community fared since the 80s to today? Is it diminished? Has it gone up and down? Or
I don't know. I left in 1980 to pursue another career for a while so I could make a living. And so I sort of left it, I really left it. It was just always this part of me. But I know that there were a couple other people who came to Vashon. Liz Lewis, very, very famous person who has been a really just a pillar of the artistic community, also of the education community for kids, artisan schools, and her classes at her studio as well. And so it goes on and on and on. There are no classes. People say, wouldn't it be great to get a pottery studio together? And there was, it's a huge endeavor. And so I think that there are Seattle Parks Department, also Burien, and I think King County Parks Departments have wonderful pottery studios. So it just keeps going and going and going. It's still MFAs all over the place in clay and one of the most exalted arts in Japan and China and Europe. And every culture has it. Mm-hmm. There's also in the latest Ceramics Monthly, there's an article on the pots of Ghana. And they are fired. They didn't have, they didn't have propane tanks in their backyard. They didn't, and so it's all fired in various, all sorts of different ways. The classic way is just wood in a heap and for a long, 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 long time. And if you've sat around a huge bonfire for any length of time, you know how hot they get. So like you said, there are lots of pots that break. But, down in the Anthropological Museum down in Mexico City, it's one of the most amazing things I've ever seen. It is pottery from Mexico, BC, pots, way prehistoric pots. And they are beautiful. It's like the old Greek ware. They are beautiful. They are fired really high. I don't know how they did it. They are, the oxides and the glazes are incredible. So people have always needed vessels, because you can carry water in a basket, but you can't cook in a basket.
Right. I got this book, The 25 Most Amazing Things in the British Museum. And one of them was soup from Japan. And they said the Japanese invented soup because they had this pottery that they could make soup in.
Right.
So was pottery developed at one place and just spread around the world, or was it independently discovered, or does anybody know?
I think that I'm fascinated by Neanderthals. And so I'm always talking about them. And thinking, we were talking about it yesterday, thinking about how it all came to be, when you think about 40,000 years ago.
Yeah.
What was going on? Where did people, because the thought is that we all, came from Lucy, the Australopithecus, down in,
Africa. We all came from Africa.
Right. We all came from Africa and somehow we got ourselves around the world. And I think that play is sort of the same way. It's that, you know, it's like people will often say, you know, what about the clay on the beach, you know, because Vashon has such, you know, so many exposed places where the clay, you know, when I lived down on Pole Road, huge bluff that in this last rainstorm is just beginning to cleave off. And the great big sand bluffs down here as well. So you can see this one is different. It's gray and it's not acting the same. So it has been, I think people just discovered it and people came by and just like all of our knowledge, like fire or anything else, I think that it, I don't know, it's kind of like part of the human.
Yeah. I'm sure culture is borrowed from other cultures. You borrow the best things and say, hey, we want to do that because that's really useful. Interesting.
Right. It's like when we went down, we went out to this great little place out in Mexico where some guy, I forget his name, of course, had made a place for his campesinos, for his workers to live, and there were still the kitchens there. And they make charcoal stoves, and I'm sure they're that way all over the world. What I thought was so great about these is that you weren't on the ground. The charcoal stoves, they were built up on stone so that you could stand and cook. And there would be a stone on top, kind of like, you know, the new fancy induction stoves now. And then you could put pots on top. So in a sense, when you put a stone between the fire and what you're cooking with, that heat is just diffused so much that you could use clay for cooking on top.
You know, it's also interesting thing about clay that I was reading is when these ancient peoples made clay, they can kind of find out when they made it, because when it's fired, all the iron molecules line up to the North Pole. I guess they all become somewhat fluid in the process, and they can tell where was the North Pole at that time. And is this different? It's really, I don't fully understand it, but I just remember the firing process let the molecules align magnetically. I thought that was so interesting.
I have never heard that. That is fascinating. Where did you hear this?
Oh, I used to work in a museum years and years ago, and that was one of the dioramas was clay pots. And I just remember that. You know, it's just one of the little signs that you read when you're going through a museum.
That's really, really, really interesting. I'm writing it down.
Okay. Well, Marla, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to do this. It's very interesting talking to you, and I know the talk is going to be just as good. So I want to let our listeners know that the talk is on April 14th. It's at 7 p.m. And you just need to go to VashonHeritageMuseum.org and register. It's free. It's a Zoom call. So thank you very much, Marla.
Yeah, thank you, Chris. Thanks a lot.
Well, listeners, as I promised, I have a very special guest here. It's Josie Islin, and she was a participant in the Natural Wonders exhibit at the museum. And she's done some wonderful work. But before we get to that, Josie, I'd like to give our listeners a little bit of your background. Josie holds a BA in Visual and Environmental Studies from Harvard and an MFA from San Francisco State University, and currently teaches in the School of Design at San Francisco State University. Very impressive.
Yeah, I started teaching in the design school a couple of years ago, and I love it. My design students are amazing. And it's I'm kind of bringing some of the art influence into the design school in terms of discipline and connection to things that you feel passionate about, trying to encourage their own personal stories to show through in their portfolios.
Well, I went through your website a bit, particularly your new book that you have out, which is Stories of the
Sea. So it's The Curious World of Seaweed, I have it right here. And there is a copy over at the Heritage Museum.
Is it available in the Vashon bookstore?
Yeah, it should be. It's if it's not findable there, they can order it for sure.
Okay.
They can just ask for it, ask for my name. And it's published by Heyday Books, a nonprofit publisher in the Bay Area. And it's 16 chapters, each one focused on one of the iconic seaweeds or kelps of our Pacific coast.
Well, you know, you read a little excerpt on your website, and what struck me is that it really reminded me of Carl Sagan, where you have this, you make scientific information consumable and relatable and enjoyable to listen to. I thought that was great.
Well, thanks. It's really, that's my goal, is to bring this world and to bring not just the quick facts of the seaweed world, which are abundant these days, but to bring the nuanced world and the kind of the magic and the poetry along with the science. And I'm not trained as a scientist, so I'm very aware that my writing needs to be understandable by people like me. And I really have, it's taken me years to kind of understand the jargon. So I'm aware of, I'm very conscious of writing without it. Right. And that's really my mission, is to use the imagery and then to use this kind of lyrical writing to bring the nearshore ocean universe, of which the seaweeds and kelps are so important, you know, they're foundational, to a broader audience, because they really are under-recognized. We go after, we talk about fish, and we talk about marine mammals, and we talk about critters. Even if you go do a basic course in the intertidal or out at the shore, you'll probably be talking about starfish and nudibranchs and even octopus, but the seaweed often get relegated to some other kind of ooey place, and I'm trying to change that.
Well, I've never met a seaweed advocate, frankly.
Well, and here you go.
Yeah, exactly. So is that a case of out of sight, out of mind, or?
Well, to a certain extent, and it's not only out of sight, out of mind, like much of the ocean universe, but there's been no commercial value to the seaweeds in our Western culture. And very much all the science, and you think about how dominant the science is around fisheries. And you have whole agencies devoted to fisheries management and figuring out the nuances of the reproductive cycles of fish and oysters and abalone and all the rest. And yet nobody has been studying the seaweeds have these very complex life cycles. And people have been studying, I don't want to say nobody, that's not true, but it's been a very, very concentrated niche. And it's just suddenly exploded, because in the last 5 years, people are realizing that the seaweeds and the seagrasses, because I want to include them, and there I have a beautiful panel of the eelgrass in the show. These are the primary producers of our nearshore oceans. And in Puget Sound here, the eelgrass and the bull kelp beds are of huge concern, because they drive fish populations and all sorts of other marine life.
Well, you know, it almost sounds like people have been studying the cows without studying the grass they rely on as the, you know, fundamental factor.
Exactly. And suddenly when situations arise where the kelp forest is disappearing very quickly, like in California, we had this kind of confluence of events that led to this steep decline in our kelp forest. All of a sudden, there's this hue and cry. It's like, yeah, if we're not paying attention, these things can happen, especially when one of the things why I think, say, the show at the museum is so important is to build up this sense of our responsibility towards building back resilience into these ocean ecologies, because we've been mining out that resilience for hundreds of years. And it's what, you know, indigenous and tribal communities were so good at maintaining, even though they were using and managing these ecologies, they were maintaining the resilience within them, the balance. And we came along and pulled out all the sea otter. Sea otter kept urchins in check. And then you combine a lack of a top predator to the urchins. And the urchins are these huge herbivores. They're like the cows. They eat the kelp, and they can eat it voraciously if their populations explode. And then you add changing water temperature to the equation. These kelps, especially the large North Pacific kelps, need cold ocean to grow in this incredibly robust way. So cold oceans hold more nutrients, you know, and our ocean is just full of nutrients that get uptaken, Well, there's upwelling, which is what brings those deep water, nutrient-rich ocean waters to the surface. And that's what the seaweeds use in combination with sunlight to generate this really robust growth that then is the bottom of the food chain for this very complex food web. So if the water's warm, they cannot hold, it's some, the physics of density, it's not holding as much, as many nutrients. And so the algal growth will be reduced if you have a warm year, which we've had, you know, when we get those warm years. You can tell immediately if you go out to the tide pools and the seaweeds are not that big on a given spring, you probably have warmer ocean that year.
So what's the difference between kelp and seaweed, or is it just semantics?
No, kelp is a subset of the seaweeds. So seaweed is kind of the popular term for marine algae, algae that grow in the marine environment, or macroalgae, because there's also the microalgae, the single-celled algae. But these kelps are a subset of the brown category. There are three evolutionary lineages of the seaweeds. There's the greens, which evolved into the plants on land, and that's where our chlorophyll comes from, is the green algae. There's red algae, which are also usually pretty foliose-like, and they have different pigments in them, red and blue pigments that make them these beautiful colors of red. And then there's the brown algae, which is a much later evolutionary lineage. And in that brown group, you get the kelps, the large marine algae that usually have bladders. So the bladders are serving to get those blades up closer to the surface to photosynthesize more efficiently. So anything that has a bladder, a big significant bladder is in the kelp, is considered a kelp. So the kelps are a subset. They're the big ones. They're the big guys, like the bull kelp, which is so iconic to Puget Sound.
Are kelp worldwide?
Yes, there are kelps, different kelps, but there are kelp forests along each of the continent's coastlines. So the coastline of each of our continents around the world has a different suite of algae. And so the big canopy forming kelps, which are so important to make these kelp forests, are say from the Golden Gate, San Francisco Bay up north through the Pacific Northwest and BC and Alaska, bull kelp is the dominant canopy forming kelp. There is also giant kelp up here, but that really is the dominant kelp down in Southern California. When you think of those historic kelp beds in La Jolla and San Diego, that's all giant kelp. So different, a different species. And then you get down to South America and you have whole different species of kelp, as well as in Southern Australia. And the kelp forests around the world are in decline, in serious decline, and a lot of it has to do with water temperature.
You mentioned the word kelp forest. Is that analogous to a forest in the sense that these kelp are there for decades, or these species live for a few years and then something else, another one?
It's analogous. So the kelp forest term is analogous to our forests on land, in that they are these places of enormous biodiversity, and they're essential kind of eco engineers. They're called, they're habitat builders. So they're creating these long, if it's bull kelp, it's these long stipes that go up to the bulb and has these blades. If it's giant kelp, the blades are kind of fanning out all the way up, and they do not last as long as trees. They are not committing energy to woody structures because they don't have to deal with gravity. It's the buoyancy of the ocean that so they kind of devote that energy to robust growth. They grow really fast. But they also, so the bull kelp is actually an annual. So it does all of its growing. It'll grow 60 feet in a season, in a matter of months. So that's the power of sunlight. You know, the similarity is that they are the great photosynthesizers of the ocean, alongside the micro single-celled cyanobacteria. But they are like that in terms of the analogy to our terrestrial forests. And so they, you know, they degenerate much quicker. Some are annual, so the bull kelp will only last for a year to 18 months, maybe 24 months if it's a real grandma out there. But giant kelp, on the other hand, is a perennial. So those big, the holdfast that holds it to the bottom can last for three or four or five years. But it's nothing like our forests on land. So it's a really interesting conversation right now. There's a lot of talk of this recognition that the kelp forests, like our terrestrial forests, are primary producers. They're using carbon dioxide to off-gas oxygen, but are they carbon sinks the way our terrestrial forests are? That's still because they don't persist as long and they do degenerate.
Seems like a lot of nutrient turnover, you know, yearly rather than holding carbon.
Exactly. And that nutrient turnover is essential for all the near shore. When you see that seaweed rack on the shore, I hope that once people read my books or see my talks, will not be like, ew, gross. And we'll actually go look at it, look at the nuance of color and shape and texture that's in there, and also recognize that all of the little critters that are working on that kelp are just fantastic protein for all the seabirds. You know, and you think of migrating birds and any shorebirds, they need it's essential nutrient turnover in that regard.
Let me switch gears a little bit and kind of focus on how this fit in with the Natural Wonder exhibit. You know, the idea of the exhibit is that you are a salmon and you're going from the ocean to your spawning ground, and you have made two curtains as kind of the entry from the ocean. Mm-hmm. And that was the kelp one, correct?
Yes, the bull kelp curtain. Yeah, you kind of go through. They've done a wonderful job. It's magical.
Yeah, everyone should see this. It's an absolutely fascinating exhibit. One thing I want to ask you, so I went through the kelp curtain, mm-hmm. and it appeared to be hemmed down low. It was that to like mimic submersion as you go through, or was that a purpose?
It was purposeful. I've been making these curtains on this wonderful fabric, this translucent fabric, for a long time, and I've been making them as shower curtains and as curtains to hang in gallery spaces. And they really mimic the translucence of the kelp and the seagrasses themselves. But when I was talking to the curators of the show, they were mentioning that this really is a throughway, that visitors will be walking through this passageway. So we sliced them down the middle so that it was easier to walk right through the kelp as opposed to having to go around the edge of the curtain.
Okay. And that's what it feels like. I mean,
it works really well.
Yeah.
I know. I'm very, very happy with it. And I have to send some pictures. I work with a wonderful fabricator in South San Francisco, right where I live. And as a designer, it's just really wonderful to work with people that you love who are actually helping you make these things. So every time I do another installation with these curtains, I work it out with my gal Maria, and we kind of strategize on, so that slicing was, done on purpose.
Yeah. Interesting. So you go through the bull kelp, and then you hit the eelgrass,
mm-hmm.
and that is more shallower water, or?
Yes, so the bull kelp are typically, I mean, Puget Sound is kind of an interesting environment for kelp, because bull kelp, when you kind of traditionally learn about it, it's thought to be open coast. It needs all that oxygenation of turbulent waters, like off the coast of California, Oregon, and Washington. But Puget Sound has enough currents to generate that nutrient turnover for bull kelp to exist in Puget Sound. But eelgrass, so I just want to kind of point out that eelgrass is similarly important and makes its habitat forming structures throughout the Northern Hemisphere, and is typically in bays and estuaries, much calmer waters. And it's not an algae, it's a flowering plant. So it's a flowering plant that actually migrated back from terrestrial world back into the saltwater environment. And it does flower. So I have a whole chapter on the seagrasses in my book. So it's super common here in Puget Sound. If you go out to the beach, I went out to the beach just on my way to the high school yesterday, and there was mostly the eelgrass in the rack line. Hmm. And it's similarly important as the kelp forest in that it is a carbon sink. It's actually sequestering carbon probably even a little better, because it actually does have roots, usually into some kind of a muddy or sandy soil. So it has a rhizome root system that does persist. And again, it is, you can see little, if you look at that curtain, there's a few little half moons that are chomped out of some of the blades. And that's some critter coming along and eating the eelgrass, because these, most of the limpets and snails and isopods, they're all herbivores, and the herbs are the seagrasses. It's like the cows eating the grass.
Yeah. Well, I know that Quartermaster Harbor is an IBA, an important bird area, designated by the Audubon Society. And I think a large part of that's due to eelgrass, which the migrating
absolutely
birds.
It all follows up from these primary producers, because where the eelgrass is rich, you have all sorts of worms and isopods, again, these little bugs that are eating and scraping off, eating the algae off the blades of the eelgrass so that it can photosynthesize better. And those, of course, are fabulous, you know, menu for seabirds or for any birds. So it really, these eco-engineers and primary producers are just, I can't emphasize how important they are for so many different levels, whether it's a marine system or our terrestrial or avian, you know, bird systems. They're kind of the bottom of the food chain. And then it spreads out in all directions.
You know, talk about an average guy like myself. How would someone like me advocate for kelp and seaweed? And what can I do to help, kind of thing?
Well, I think one of the first things is just knowing about it. You know, like now being aware, that both the kelp and the seagrasses are super important. And then there's all sorts of different groups that are doing pretty amazing work now. And in Puget Sound, there's a wonderful group called the Puget Sound Restoration Fund. And they are doing lots of bull kelp restoration work and connection with local tribes and learning their kind of uses of bull kelp and building awareness around how the bull kelp is doing right now. So, and I'm sure there are many opportunities to volunteer with them. So the Puget Sound Restoration Fund is one group. There's another wonderful group, if someone's a diver, or if you have kids who are about to go to college, they can learn to dive and get a scientific diving certificate. And then there's a really interesting and valuable group called Reef Check. And Reef Check is, I think, a nationwide, could even be, excuse me, global, but we have Reef Check California, and I believe they're establishing a Reef Check in Washington State. Hmm. And what Reef Check does is it trains volunteer divers to go out into these specific survey points and to survey them so that they are collecting the data on what's actually happening out there in the oceans. And if you're not a diver, they're a nonprofit organization. You can donate money to them. Another thing that's been really fun for me is to connect with the surfing community. And in California, the surfing community is huge advocates for the ocean. And there's a group called Sustainable Surf, who are a bunch of surfers who've decided to figure out how to leverage their community to help these kelp restoration efforts and mangrove restoration efforts around the world. So they really vet the projects, and then they funnel donations to kelp restoration efforts. So Sustainable Surf, you can find them, you can follow them on Instagram, they're wonderful. You can buy a really eco-friendly surfboard. For the kayaking community, kayakers are important in Puget Sound for doing some of these kelp surveys. So I think just being aware is the first step.
Are any of these species have any kind of economic importance? Like, are they farmed?
Well, it's interesting. Well, so kelp farming has suddenly become, you know, a big talking point. And it's not new. People have been farming kelp. It's very easy to grow kelp. It's got a very complex life cycle, but it's actually very easy to seed line and put it out into the ocean. And the beauty of kelp farming is that you seed the line, you put it out into your cold ocean, you do not use fertilizer, you don't use fresh water, you don't feed it, you don't do anything. The nutrients of the ocean and the power of the sunlight is what drives this really quite astounding accumulation of biomass that's edible. So kelp farming around in Asia, of course, has been massive for many, long time. And in some states, the kelp farming is really going gangbusters. And those states that I'm aware of are Maine, for one, and Alaska, for another. So yes. Those states have really, really encouraged kelp farming as a kind of an alternate way to keep working waterfronts vibrant, and keep a younger generation in the fishing business or on their boats on the water. California, on the other hand, and I think probably Washington State, is much more regulatorily tight-fisted in terms of access to permitting for kelp farms. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I think as an artist and just kind of someone who's been looking at the lay of the land for a long time, I'm always a little afraid when some kelp farming enterprise gets really successful. Because right. Our whole capitalist mode is that you start a business, and if it does well, you bigger it. The Lorax, is...
Then it's a monoculture, and you lose the diversity because everything's kelp.
Right, everything's kelp. They have done, sea bottom studies. I think that's, what happens underneath these kelp beds. But on the other hand, there is a lot of kind of anticipation of combining kelp or seagrass growth around oyster farms and mussel farms, because they mediate the photosynthesizing organisms, the kelp, actually mediate the acidification. They're putting, they're uptaking the carbon dioxide that is causing the acidification. So they're pulling that out of just a very localized system. So that can help the shell building growth of the oysters. So there's lots of interesting research going on out there. And I am a big advocate for oyster farms. And I feel like we need oysters and mussels and clams. These are filter feeders. We need different sources of protein that are not fish. I really, in my own habits, I really try to eat oysters and mussels and clams and fish only very rarely. I know that's sacrilege here in the Pacific Northwest, but I feel like we need to let the fish be if we can a little bit. And so I think it's being studied in different places in very different ways, the kelp farming. I want to add that it's very different than fish aquaculture, because you're not putting feed into the system. There's no poop, there's no detritus. I mean, there's kelp detritus, which actually does feed other invertebrates, but you don't have the effluent of the fish, and you don't have dead fish, stuff like that.
I was just going to say, aquaculture for fish held such promise, decades ago, and it really hasn't been as advertised.
Although I think if you look into it, there are huge advances happening in that regard in terms of keeping it.
I believe so too, because they've seen, like you said, the detritus and all the effluents of the fish and all the bad things that need to be mitigated. Anything else?
No, just I hope people get out to the beach and I hope people come see the show, which is fabulous, and then take that out to the beach and really take notice of what they find. And find my books, The Curious World of Seaweed. As an author, again, seaweed, it's clear seaweed's not a big seller. It's not like fish or flowers or what have you. And so even really good books actually they don't languish, but they need that energy. And that's really what I'm trying to bring to this world, because it is kind of underrepresented in terms of the storytelling out there.
I absolutely agree. I mean, it's not pretty. It's not beautiful.
It is
pretty, though.
It is. It's very pretty.
It's an acquired taste. It's an acquired taste, maybe. But
if you get my books, if you get my books, you will be convinced that it's very pretty. And we're making artwork. I'm here to do these workshops with the high school. So today we're getting to make the blue cyanotypes using my seaweed specimens, and they will be very pretty, I assure you.
I'm sure they will.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to do this. It's an absolutely interesting subject and one that needs to be told. Wish
my
you
pleasure.
All the luck in the world.
Great. Thank you so much.
Well, that's it for our April show. I'd like to thank Marla Smith and Josie Island for joining me for wonderful interviews. Unfortunately, we've had to cut out some of our regular segments, but I really didn't want to shorten our time with both of those speakers. Also, like to thank the folks behind the microphone, Elsa Kroonquist, Bruce Hallman, who are always so helpful putting these together. And make sure to sign up for the Zoom talk on April 14th with Marla Smith and the rest of the panel. And be sure to come by the museum itself and see the Natural Wonder exhibit and see Josie's excellent work. See you next month.